2. City of Talitha, Talith Bay, Earldom of Stormkeep, Princedom of Coruscant. There was nothing remarkable about the two merchant galleons lying to anchor well out from the harborside quays of the city of Talitha. They'd arrived separately, hours apart, one flying the house flag of a rather disreputable Manchir trading house, and the other of Chisomian registry. They'd anchored within a few hundred yards of one another, then proceeded to ignore each other as they awaited their own turns to go along quayside or lighter their cargo ashore. Neither seemed in any particular hurry, since their skippers hadn't made any special push to arrange to land their cargoes, but no one in Talitha cared particularly about that. In fact, no one in Talitha paid them the slightest mind as they lay there, a handful of men moving about their decks, watching darkness settle slowly over the bay. Lights began to glow here and there ashore, nothing like the illumination one might have seen out of Telesburg or Chiraeth or even Manchir, but glittering like beached stars nonetheless. They seemed even brighter tonight than they might have been otherwise, since there happened to be no moon. Complete darkness closed in, turning the galleons into all but invisible black blots against the only slightly brighter water. Stars came out overhead, briefly mirrored in the oily smooth swell, but even as they appeared, clouds began sweeping in from the east. This, Sir Corin Garvey thought, standing on the quarterdeck of one of those galleons and watching the incoming clouds steadily erase the stars, is ridiculous. I'm willing to believe in Sagans, I guess, and I suppose, especially after listening to Father talk about conversions, I can accept that God is on Archbishop Michael's side. That's not the same thing as being on Caleb's side, though, and even if it were, how did even a Sagan arrange a night like this? It's like the archangels delivered the damned weather to order. Under the circumstances, it was a reasonable enough question. Then again, Garvey didn't know about snarks, or an AI named Owl, or the meteorological projections he could make. Nor did he have any idea that Merlin Athrawis, thousands of miles away in Telesburg, could arrange to have one of Al's remotes quietly deliver his message on a timetable designed to get Garvey and his raiders here at precisely this time. Actually, Merlin had aimed for any spot in a 4-day window. In fact, he'd been prepared to settle for missing the window completely, given the vagaries of wind, weather, and the unpredictable interference of Murphy. It had seemed worth shooting for, though, and Garvey and Howell Cherman had surprised him with how quickly they'd moved. They'd been fortunate with the wind on their passage from Manchir as well. Which was how Sir Corin Garvey found himself watching the galleons sway their boats, rather larger and more numerous than most merchant galleons might have carried if anyone had noticed, over the side on a calm, windless night, blacker than the inside of an old boot. He was confident they would have managed under other weather conditions, but he wasn't about to look a gift dragon in the mouth when God decided to give him perfect weather conditions, even if he didn't know how the Sagans had arranged it. Now he waited as the first wave of Imperial Carisian Marines and Coruscantian Guardsmen, who'd hidden below decks all day, swarmed quietly up out of the galleon's hatches and then down into the waiting boats. In all, there were almost 1,000 men spread between the two merchantmen. Even with a larger-than-usual complement of boats, they couldn't land that many troops at once. On the other hand, after carefully studying charts of the harbor and the maps which had accompanied the mysterious letter, Garvey and Major Daniel Porter, the senior Marine Company commander, had picked likely spots to land the first wave. Garvey waited until the last man but one of the first wave had climbed down, then dropped lightly over the galleon's side himself. He slid down the rope until Yeoman Alston, waiting below, reached up and grabbed the heel of one boot. Alston guided his foot down to one of the boat's thwarts, and Garvey released the rope and dropped the last inch or so. "All right," he said quietly. "Let's go."